Welcome to the first History Today podcast of 2014. In this episode, we speak to Richard Waite about Britain's complex relationship with its revolutionary past. Richard's article, Reluctant Regicides, which he co-wrote with Toby Haggath, is the cover story for our February issue, which is out later this week. Also in this issue, Andrew Pettigrew outlines the birth of the newspaper in early modern Europe. Chris Turney uncovers a possible cover-up relating to the tragic demise of Captain Scott's expedition to the South Pole. Mary Erler reveals a remarkable cache of letters which shed light on the unlikely relationship between Thomas Cromwell and a female religious. And Patricia Farah considers the opportunities for scientists, particularly women, during the First World War. The February issue is out on newsstands from January 23rd. You can also download the digital edition for iPad, Kindle Fire, Android tablet, and smartphones by visiting www.historytoday.com/app. Now, here's Paul Lay speaking to Richard Waite about Britain's reluctant regicides.
Our cover story for the February edition of History Today is Reluctant Regicides, in which Richard Waite and Toby Haggath discuss why modern Britons find it so hard to acknowledge their revolutionary pasts. And Richard Waite joins us. In a recent Home Office publication, a survey of British history, omitted all references to the civil wars because, and I quote, the wounds are still too fresh. It seems surprising that anyone should think that's the case.
I think it's extraordinary, Paul. I mean, the English killed their king and they don't like to talk about it. And it is extraordinary, given that it's had such an influence on, in the 18th century, on American revolutionaries, on French revolutionaries. And yet here in Britain, it's treated either with a collective amnesia, embarrassment, on both sides, on both, you know, the royalist majority and the Republican minority are embarrassed by it. And that's extraordinary because it's not just a great bit of our history, but an influential piece of world history.
You might even say that's the case for the whole period of the Civil Wars.
Yes, that's right. It's because it just conflicts with what used to be called the Whig interpretation of history. But still, to some extent, we have that narrative of our history of a democracy that evolves peacefully. Hence the fact we prefer to talk about the Glorious Revolution of 1688 and the more peaceful transition to representative government. And the Civil War, as you said, generally, not just the regicide, but the whole Civil War period conflicts with that rather cosy narrative. It's a revolution. And of course, kings have been killed before, but they've been killed usually on the field of battle, fighting foreign enemies, or in secret through, you know, the dynastic struggles of the medieval and early modern period. But here was a king who was killed, and Cromwell was very insistent that the king should be killed in the sight of his people. Of course, before TV and the internet, in the sight of his people meant a few thousand people in Whitehall. But nonetheless, this was done in public. And the other difference was it was done for ideological reasons. It was done in the name of the people, the citizens. It wasn't about dynastic struggle or foreign battles.
Because, of course, the English had killed their kings before, but never explicitly in an ideological way, as they did in 1649. I mean, we can see certainly that it's a shocking moment then. And, of course, there's the case of Penny, which is always the observation that's made of contemporary references to that. So that's the young boy who was witness to the regicide.
Yes, what's been repeated, I mean, in books that I read R.J. Unstead's Illustrated Histories of Britain when I was a kid, and the one on the Civil War says repeats this quote from this teenage witness saying, as you know, as the head, Charles I's head fell, it was such a groan as I never heard before and desire I may never hear again. But actually he was a courtier in the Restoration. His father had been very close to Charles I. He's not what you call an objective observer. And I think a lot of the reason that the regicide's been written out is the way the Restoration's been written in. We're taught, I certainly was, I think to some extent it's still true, that, you know, exit the Puritans, enter Nell Gwynn and Christopher Wren. Mm-hmm. Fun and invention replace trauma and stagnation. And I think, actually, there was really bloody revenge. You know, 10 of the regicides were publicly executed in front of Charles II, and Samuel Pepys witnessed some of the executions. And actually, Charles II's ministers advised him that this was actually backfiring with public opinion, that they didn't want to see this brutal revenge taken on the men who'd signed his father's death warrant. So clearly public opinion, it's not to say that everyone was in favour of the regicide, but public opinion was much more balanced than we've been led to believe, I think.
I think perhaps as well there may well be an aspect of this, the decline of political history as well, the raising in stature of social history, for example. And so in those terms, the restoration period, when we talk, it's a sexier sort of period than that of the civil wars and the protectorate, which is much more of a political issue, great men history, if you like, to a large extent. And maybe that's out of its time as well. But every so often, this re-emerges in English history, an interest in the regicides, in the civil wars, isn't it?
Yeah, I think that's a really interesting point, and I'd agree with you that it's a lot to do with, you know, and I'm a social and cultural historian, I'm part of that, but it's a lot to do with the rise of social and cultural history and getting away from the titanic struggles between powerful men. And I think that is one of the reasons that the story of the regicide has been lost. But as you said, it comes back, and in some unlikely places. It's not surprising, perhaps, that the Tolpuddle Martyrs cited the regicide as a precedent for taking on the power of the British political elite. But more surprising, perhaps, is that a lot of Edwardian liberals, Winston Churchill was one of them, who saw Cromwell as a father of democracy. Now, people like Churchill weren't in favour of regicide. In fact, they too were quite embarrassed by it. But in the late 19th, early 20th century, the liberal struggle for parliamentary democracy used the regicide and used the Civil War as part of their narrative and as a precedent. So, for example, there's a campaign for House of Lords reform in 1884. Huge crowds stopped at the spot in Whitehall where Charles had been beheaded, and speeches were made warning the monarchy and the elite, if they resisted reform of the House of Lords, then there was a precedent for dealing with the monarchy. So there wasn't the embarrassed silence there is now. As I said, Churchill, for example, at the turn of the century, when he was First Lord of the Admiralty, he suggested that a dreadnought be named His Majesty's ship Oliver Cromwell. And George V described this as an offensive oxymoron, and the plan was dropped. So people like Churchill saw this as part of the story of British democracy. And when Churchill was Prime Minister during the Second World War, he commissioned a tank called the Oliver Cromwell, which saw action from 1943 onwards. So he'd failed to get a dreadnought named after his hero, but he got a tank named after it instead. It's not until after the Second World War that the regicide and the Civil War are almost erased from the story of British democracy.
And why do you think that is? It seems curious. I mean, for instance, when we look at the example of the Cromwell tank, this is 1943. This is a time of great popular democracy. You think it anticipates the 1945 election, for example, where Labour wins a landslide election. There's the talk of the New Jerusalem here. And yet we see the abandonment almost of interest in the civil wars.
Yes, that's right. I think it's partly because there is a fear in the Labour Party of being seen to be too radical and of upsetting the monarchy. A year before the first Labour government in 1923, the Labour Party conference debated whether the Labour Party was a Republican Party or not, and it decisively voted that it wasn't a Republican Party, it was a Royalist Party. But when a year later, when Labour won their sort of their narrow election victory, George Lansbury, the senior Labour politician, told a big meeting in London that there was a precedent for the king, the king losing his head if he resists the will of Parliament. This was a leading Labour politician using the regicide to concentrate George V's mind on appointing a minority Labour government. Mm. And it led to a huge, huge controversy. Conservative associations said this has opened a new civil war between royalists and anti-royalists. Some conservatives threatened to shoot Lansbury. George V was so rattled by it that he had a quiet word with Ramsay MacDonald at their first meeting, just as Ramsay MacDonald became the first Labour Prime Minister, and he said, I don't want Lansbury in the government.
Yeah.
And MacDonald agreed. So a combination of royal anxiety, the King's anxiety about republicanism, and Labour embarrassment, and a fear that Labour would lose moderate votes if it used the regicide, even rhetorically, as Lansbury had done. And I think what happened then in 1923 and 24 then echoed in the mid-1940s and onwards.
And curiously, I mean, I've got that quote here, and it is quite a really striking quote. I shall quote it now. A King of England had once stood out against the will of the common people, and he had lost his head. King George V would be well advised not to interfere. Such jiggery pokery is to be resisted. That's Lansbury. That is an astonishing quote from
it
a Labour politician.
Paul. Alluding to it, is he? I mean, it's almost a direct threat.
It's almost a threat, yeah.
You mess with Labour government and the Labour movement, you'll end up on a scaffold outside Whitehall, he's essentially saying.
Well, one of the most curious aspects of this in recent months, even, is the way in which its members of the Conservative Party, and I think now of people like Daniel Hannan and Douglas Carswell, on the right of the Conservative Party at that, who are more likely to invoke Cromwell and that period in positive terms than anyone in the Labour Party.
Yes, that is extraordinary. And I think it goes to back to, although Churchill was a liberal when he suggested a dreadnought be named after Cromwell.
Well, these are very Whiggish Tories, I suppose.
Yes, exactly, yeah. And but actually it goes back to, you know, a conservative narrative, as well as a liberal and socialist one, you know, a conservative, a one-nation conservative narrative, but a conservative narrative about British democracy, and that sometimes peaceful evolution isn't possible, that sometimes, you know, you need tough love in the sense to get democracy into being. And I think the Labour Party is still paralysed by this fear of being tainted with the Republican cause, and in a funny way, that frees up conservatives to do as Cromwell did and use it as part of their story of British democracy, and particularly, of course, in reference to the European Union as well, protecting democracy,
parliamentary sovereignty,
which is ironic given that the regicide and the Civil War inspired European democratic movements.
And let's just talk about that one moment, because I mean, obviously, it inspired European republican movements, but perhaps the most lingering effect was on the other side of the Atlantic. Where indeed you have three of the regicides escape to North America.
Yeah, that's right. And they have streets named after them in New Haven. And they're seen as... they were some of the few regicides to actually escape the vengeance of Charles II. They became kind of forefathers of the American Revolution. One of the most extraordinary things about this is while the British have forgotten about the regicides, they're actually memorialised more in the United States. And if you think about Churchill's idea of the English-speaking peoples and, you know, the Anglo-Saxon diaspora bringing democracy to the world, we think about that in terms of the peaceful evolution of parliaments, but actually, certainly I think what Churchill had in mind was also this revolutionary tradition, which the Americans still acknowledge, and the French and other Europeans to a lesser extent. But, I mean, one of the regicides was the founder of Harvard University.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So there is this extraordinary disconnect between Britain's revolution being ignored by the British and being honoured abroad, not least in the United States.
Well, let's hope your article, Reluctant Regicides, it's the cover... cover article for the February edition of History Today. Let's hope it goes some way to reigniting this debate, which I think is a much needed one. So thank you, Richard. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Paul.